Of the universe, peace and blessings upon the servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Amen. I greet you with a greeting that is common in Islam, a greeting of peace. Assalamu alaikum. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we continue with our fifth program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. And our topic for today will deal with production and productivity. I have joining me on the program as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Before we get into today's topic, could I have you very quickly highlight and summarize the main points that we talked about in our fourth program in the series dealing with consumption last week?
Okay, in the previous program we started to apply the broad principles in Islamic economics, the foundation, the geological foundation, if you will, on specific topics, and we started dealing with the question of consumption. And in order to make it easy to grasp, we try to make comparisons between consumption as viewed from the point of view of Islam vis-a-vis the common Western economist way of looking at it. And the comparison included five basic things. First, the question of success. And we indicated that success for a Muslim economist means not only just the economic success, but a much broader success in this life and hereafter. The second, the question of the time horizon or time scale in taking consumption decisions, and said again for the Muslim that involves short run, medium range, as well as long term, this life and hereafter, this generation and future generations. Thirdly, the idea of wealth, which we indicated again, Islam does not see it as all evil or all good, but mainly it is a means rather than ends. The fourth point, the notion of economic commodity or goods, and indicated that this is defined a little bit differently from the economist definition, that it is not simply something that somebody wants or somebody can consume, because in Islam it is not regarded as good if it is contrary to its moral laws, such as, you know, drugs or other vices. And finally, the fifth point was that in consumption there are certain ethics that the Quran also established, such as avoiding miserliness or excessiveness and keeping reasonable balance.
Mm-hmm. Well, now turning to today's topic of production or and productivity, what in your opinion motivates a true Muslim to be productive?
Well, based on the fundamental principles that particularly this covered in the first program of this series, it was indicated that the human being is created as the Khalifa, or the trustee of God on earth, and that one of our duties as human beings on earth is to establish civilization which combines moral values as well as material progress. It was also indicated that God created the universe and all the resources in the universe in order to help us fulfill this duty of trusteeship. So these are like tools to fulfill our duties. It follows from that exploration of the various resources and harnessing them is not only permissible in Islam, it is a duty. In fact, you can view it as a duty similar to the duty also to worship or have certain acts of prayer, because worship in Islam involves all activities of the human life. To come specifically to the issue of motivation for productivity, well, a Muslim would share with others at least one aspect of this motivation. People become or try to become productive simply to survive economically and improve their well-being. And of course, there's no dispute with that. A Muslim economist would look at it also in the same way. But beyond that, a true Muslim would have an additional and strong motivation to be productive. Not only to survive or improve, but to obey God. That is, the Quran itself exhort the humans, exhort the believers in particular, to be active, to be productive, to benefit from the resources that God has created, for which they get reward not only in this life but also in the hereafter. So that expands the view of the person and keeps the motivation even in a much higher and much stronger level if the person is truly a committed believer. May I add also one more thing that reflects the true Islamic attitude? One of the prayers or supplications that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, used to say, Allahumma inni a'udhu bika min al-hammi wal-hazan wa a'udhu bika min al-'ajzi wal-kasal. Oh God, I seek refuge in you from worry and grief, and then he adds, and from helplessness and laziness. So he considered helplessness and laziness as something negative that a true believer really should seek refuge from, should try to avoid.
Mm-hmm. Well, now from your response to the, in the earlier part of your response to my question, it, it seemed to be a bit of a contradiction or the opposite of what the media in the West portrays when it speaks about Islam, and that it normally suggests that Islamic revival and Islam is opposed to progress. Would you comment on that?
I would say that this kind of notion that is still even strange enough, common until today, even though there is lots of exchange of information between different peoples, is a myth. You know, what is being said about this notion is really a myth, which is incorrect conceptually and untrue historically. There is no single verse in the entire Quran that can be construed as giving a negative attitude or approach towards legitimate progress and improvement of the human lot on earth as well as in the life hereafter. There is no such distinction in Islam. The contrary, in fact, is true. The Quran is full of verses and directives, if you will, to benefit from the universe, for the benefit of oneself, one family, and for humanity at large, as indicated earlier, as part even of the tools to fulfill the duties of khilafah or trusteeship.
Could I perhaps have you share some of the examples on what you've just been saying that are contained in the Quran?
Okay, let's look at some examples of basic resources, basic sectors in the economy or areas where in any age it has been quite crucial. I'm not saying an exclusive list, but throughout history you look at the for example agricultural resources, one. You look at water resources, you can look at fisheries as one resource, you can look at animal resources, various industries also that stem from all of this. And if I may, I just chose these four maybe to give you direct quotations or examples from the Quran. Let's take the agricultural resources. Mm-hmm. In chapter 13 in the Quran, in verse 4, وَفِي الْأَرْضِ قِطَعٌ مُتَجَاوِرَاتٌ, I'll just read the translation of the verse. It says, and in the earth are tracts, diverse though neighboring, and gardens of vines, and fields sown with corn, and palm trees growing out of single roots, or otherwise watered with the same water, yet some of them we make more excellent than others to eat. Behold, verily in these things there are signs for those who understand. So there is reference there as to how to benefit from agricultural resources and regard it actually as a bounty or blessing from God. Take the water resources, for example, especially as it relates to agriculture also. An interesting reference made in the Quran in chapters 22, in verse 5, وَتَرَى الْأَرْضَ هَامِدَةً, in the translation, and further you see the earth barren and lifeless, but when you pour down rain on it, it is stirred to life, it swells, and it puts forth every kind of beautiful growth in pairs. Not only this, there is frequent reference in the Quran also to the rainfall, and long before scientists even could make this clear connection, the Quran makes connection between rainfalls and springs and water that gets into the bottom of the earth. For example, in chapter 39, verse 21, أَلَمْ تَرَ أَنَّ اللَّهَ أَنزَلَ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً فَسَلَكَهُ يَنَبِيعَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. In the translation it reads, "See you not that God sends down rain from the sky and leads it through springs in the earth, then he causes to grow therewith produce of various colors, then it withers. You will see it grow yellow, then he makes it dry up and crumble away. Truly, in this is a message of remembrance to persons of understanding." In addition to the benefit of waters, you know, for the agricultural purposes, the Quran also makes reference to the use of the seas for seafaring purposes, for example. And so that's an early mention of the seafaring. In chapter 45, verse 12, for example, أَلَمْ تَرَ أَنَّ اللَّهَ سَخَّرَ لَكُمُ الْبَحْرَ لِتَجْرِيَ الْفُلْكُ فِيهِ بِأَمْرِ. It is God who has subjected the sea to you, that ships may sail through it by his command, that you may seek of his bounty, and that you may be grateful. You notice here the reference to seeking of the bounty of God is not even restricted to just benefiting in a sense of just seafaring or transportation, but it could also make a reference to all kinds of resources that could be harnessed and benefits from the sea. Mm-hmm. We mentioned also that the third possible example we can give is in the area of fishery. Again, the Quran in more than one place make reference to that, just to choose one in chapter 16, in verse 14, for example, وَهُوَ الَّذِي سَخَّرَ الْبَحْرَ لِتَأْكُلُوا مِنْهُ لَحْمًا طَرِيًّا. It is he, that is God, who has made the sea subject, that you may eat therefrom flesh that is fresh and tender, reference to fish, and that you may extract therefrom ornament to wear. And you see the ships therein that plow the waves, that you may seek thus of the bounty of God, and that you may be grateful. So we hear about the recent laws of the sea, conferences dealing with the various utilizations that could be made out of the oceans, whether you talk about tidal powers or other minerals. While the Quran does not give all these details, but it opened the door wide by giving like a carte blanche, really, of exploring all these resources and benefiting, as the verse says, لِتَبْتَغُوا مِنْ فَضْلِهِ, so you can seek the bounty or blessings of God. The first example I suggested you can refer to another source of wealth, for example, the animal wealth. In chapter 16 also, in the Quran, there is an interesting reference to that, not only to animal for just for the purpose of food, but to varieties of uses and industries that may grow as a result of this animal resources. In the beginning, towards the beginning of the first of the chapter 16, وَالْأَنْعَامَ خَلَقَهَا لَكُمْ. It says, and cattle he has created for you, from them you derive warmth, and that's a reference again to the leather industry, taking the hides and benefiting from it by way of clothing and so on, and numerous benefits. Notice the term numerous benefits, whatever you can think of and benefit from the animal resources. And of their meat you eat. So here is meat and meat packing industries. And you have a sense of pride and beauty in them as you drive them home in the evening and as you lead them forth to pasture in the morning. So that's again another aesthetic aspect in the animal, the question of sports, horse riding, that this is an additional benefit also to drive. And then it goes on. And they carry your heavy loads to lands that you could not otherwise reach except with souls distressed, for your Lord is indeed most kind, most merciful. Well, can you say that this is perhaps an early mention of the trucking industry? You see, it talks about animals carrying your loads. if God has given us the capability and the resources to be able to replace, the animals with other trucks or cars, that's also a kind of reference in general to the area of transportation. And it goes on and on, and in fact, these are only, I should say, few examples that you find among many others in the Quran. In fact, it can all be summarized in one verse that is found in the second chapter in the Quran, verse 29. It says, وَسَخَّلَ لَكُمْ مَا فِي الْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا مِنْ, that God has made subservient to you everything that is on earth, all a gift from Him. Everything. So whether you talk about these four types of resources, any other thing that you can benefit from, the Quran says that God has made available to you. So where is this contradiction between progress and productivity and the basic spiritual and moral teachings of Islam?
Mm-hmm. Well, now, so far in your comments, you've placed emphasis on resources here on Earth. We're living in an age now of space exploration. How about the possible, from an economic perspective, the exploration of space and possible benefits from resources that might possibly be available in outer space?
You mean whether that's permissible or religiously speaking?
Yes.
It is interesting that in several verses in the Quran, when it talks about God making subservient to you anything or everything on earth, many of these verses also use "and in heavens." Just to give you one example of that, in chapter 45, verse 13, وَسَخَّرَ لَكُمْ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا مِنْ, that God has made, had made subservient to you everything that is on earth and everything that is in heaven. So it shows that it is not only permissible, to use and harness these forces. If you want to discover and benefit from something on Mars or the Moon or whatever, go ahead. This is quite a contrast with some of the ideas that might have preceded Islam or even succeeded Islam, where even exploration of space or trying to learn something about the stars was regarded as something heretical or encroachment on the domain of God. The Quran doesn't look at it this way. It says that God created for you. So if you have the ability, if you have the technology and science to explore and benefit from space, go ahead. It's permissible. There's no problem at all. And that includes even not just the harnessing of possible resources that might exist there in space, but also try to understand, of course, the laws that God created in nature.
So let me infer from what you just said that the study of natural laws and phenomena is something that is encouraged and urged by the Quran.
Well, in fact, it's not only urged, but you find, as we have quoted, for example, in the area of harnessing resources, you find also numerous references in the Quran trying to open our eyes on this kind of laws that God has created. Take, for example, an issue like the revolution or alternation of day and night, and as it relates, of course, to many other phenomena and aspects that we study, which relate, again, to economic prosperity and progress. We find, for example, in chapter 24 in the Quran, in verse 44, يُقَلِّبُ اللَّهُ اللَّيْلَ وَالنَّهَارِ, that God alternates the day and night. Indeed, in this are instructive examples for those with vision. In a very moving and very interesting passage in the Quran, which again opened the door wide for exploration and understanding of the various phenomena in the universe. إِنَّ فِي خَلْقِ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَاخْتِلَافِ اللَّيْلِ وَالنَّهَارِ, in chapter 3, verse 191, in the translation of many, it reads, "Behold, in the creation of heavens and the earth, and the alternation of night and day, there are indeed signs for persons of understanding. Those who celebrate the praises of God, standing, sitting, and lying down on their sides." Notice the following word: "And contemplate the wonders of creation in the heavens and the earth, with the thought, "Our Lord, you have not created all this in vain. Glory be to you. Give us salvation from the penalty of the fire." So, in a way, somebody might say this is a special verse. It deals with the worship of God, with supplication, with the knowledge and proof to oneself of the existence and the hand of God in the creation of this universe. But that spiritual part is very much connected. It's inseparable from what the verse says, ويتفكرون, and they think, they contemplate about the creation of heavens and earth, which says, again, go ahead and study and try to understand this wonders that God has placed in the universe. Another interesting thing also that seems to relate to direct relation, I should say, to economic aspects, is the study of the rain and how it comes about. And again, I leave it to scientists to judge, you know, how could, in the 7th century, that's almost 1400 years ago, a person receive a revelation like that? Where is the source of this kind of information? In chapters 24, in verse 43, it says, أَلَمْ تَرَ أَنَّ اللَّهَ يُسْجِي سَحَابًا, see you not that God makes the cloud move gently, then joins them together, then makes them into a heap, then will you see rain issue forth from their midst, and he sends down from the sky mountain masses of clouds, wherein is hail, he strikes therewith whom he pleases, and he turns it away from whom he pleases. And notice this, the vivid flash of his lightning, well might blinds the sight. Possible reference to the electric charges that is connected with the issuing force of rain from the sky. So again, this is something that the Quran says, see you not, haven't you seen, haven't you thought, studied, contemplated on this phenomenon in nature. In the study of things like astronomy, for example, and trying to understand and appreciate the various aspects created in nature, in chapters 36 in the Quran, you find an interesting reference to a number of phenomena in nature that God has created, which again is put there or presented with a view of encouraging us to try to study them. وَآيَةٌ لَهُمُ اللَّيْلُ نَسْلَخُ مِنْهُ النَّهَارُ. From beginning from that verse it says, and a sign for them, that's for mankind, is the night. We withdraw therefrom the day, and behold, they are plunged in darkness. And the sun runs his course for a period determined, for him that is the decree of him, capital H, the exalted in might, the knowing, or all-knowing. And the moon, we have measured for her mansions to traverse, then she returns like the old and withered lower part of a dead stalk. It is not permitted to the sun to catch up the moon, nor can the night outstrip the day. Each just swims along, notice the word, each of the seven bodies swims along in its own orbit according to law. Which is again a reference to the fact that heavenly bodies are not just stationary, they are swimming, that is, floating in constant motion. And again, we're talking here about revelation in the 7th century. If we really were to put it together, I would say, basically, that not only does the Quran induce humanity to search, understand, and learn the various phenomena that God created, that God created in nature, but it even blames or criticizes those who are not using this capability to understand. In fact, in one verse in the Quran, in chapter 7, verse 18, it says, أَوَلَمْ يَتَفَكَّرُوا فِي مَلَكُوتِ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَمَا خَلَقَ اللَّهُ مِنْ شَيْءٍ. Have they not, by way of blaming, have they not contemplated in the domain or considered. أَوَلَمْ يَنْظُرُوا, there's another verse also, أَوَلَمْ يَنْظُرُوا فِي مَلَكُوتِ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ, had they not seen or considered the domain of heavens and earth and what God has created therein. So it's,
your answer raises another question related to this topic of progress and economic prosperity, and that has to do with the attitude of Islam towards learning of science. Could you shed some light on that?
Well, in fact, Islam considers knowledge and science as not something which is the antithesis of faith, and not something that's opposite or inconsistent with faith. In fact, the term faith in Islam does not mean simply a dogmatic or acceptance of dogmatic assertions or acceptance of things which are totally incoherent and logically impossible. You're not saying that Islam says that reason is God to be worshipped, but there are certain things, of course, beyond the ability of human intelligence. But that's quite different from saying that a human being is required to accept something which is totally contradictory from the logical standpoint. In fact, suffice to say that the very first word, not even verse, revealed in the Quran was Iqra, the chapter 96, Iqra, recite or read. And the very few verses revealed to Prophet Muhammad first when he was contemplating in the cave of Hira outside of Mecca included teaching with the pen, you know, so there is repetition even of the tools, of possible tools of learning. Not only this, we find that the Quran also in numerous verses praises learning, regardless, of course, so long as it's all useful for humanity, whether it's in science, humanities, or the mandatory part that each person should learn about the basic requirements of his or her faith. But all these types of learnings are highly praised. In fact, the Quran indicates that through learning, God would raise people in degrees. يَرْفَعِ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَالَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْعِلْمَ دَرَجَاتٍ. That's God would raise in degrees those who are believers and those who are also given knowledge. So that's, the Quran makes it clear that we cannot equate knowledge with the lack of it. In chapter 39, verse 9, قُلْ هَلْ يَسْتَوِي الَّذِينَ يَعْلَمُونَ وَالَّذِينَ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. Say, is it equal? Can we really equate? Is it possible to equate those who know and those who know not? Not only this. In fact, the Quran in one chapter, that's chapter 32, particularly in verse 28, it makes a connection between knowledge and fear of God, or knowledge of God, science and knowledge of God. It says, إِنَّمَا يَخْشَى اللَّهَ مِنْ عِبَادِهِ الْعُلَمَاءِ, that those who are really given true knowledge are the ones who fear God, not fear in the sense of being scared, but those who are heed God, or those who are pious, or remember God. The same kind of attitude towards science and learning has been shown by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in numerous sayings, and by Haqqi, for example. He says, seeking knowledge is mandatory on every Muslim, as a generic term applying to males and females. He said, seek knowledge even in China. He's talking to people in Arabia, but of course that shows that even if you have to travel far, you have to also seek knowledge. In an interesting saying also that was narrated in Abu Dawood and the Tirmidhi, in which the Prophet says that any person who seeks or takes a path or road towards knowledge, God will facilitate a road for him towards heavens or paradise, that the angels would lower their wings to the person who's seeking knowledge in satisfaction of what he's doing, and that a person who's knowledgeable have everybody making or seeking forgiveness for him in heavens and earth, even fish would ask for forgiveness for him, that the advantage of a person who is learned over one who is simply worshipping without knowledge is like the advantage of the moon over other stars, that the scientists or people who are given knowledge, true knowledge, are the ears, or the ears of the prophets, and that the prophets have never left money behind them, but they left knowledge. So all of these are regarded as highly praiseworthy things, to the point that it is equated with a jihad. In At-Tirmidhi, the Prophet says, a person who goes out in the pursuit of knowledge, he is actually struggling in the path of God.
Mm-hmm. Well, we leave it at that for today. We want to thank you for being our guest and invite you back next week when we'll continue with our sixth program, and dealing with the economic system of Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Allah, 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 All